sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
China's economic horror show. Earnings, hit or miss. Markets, fear no Fed to the rescue. And our guest, Ed Conway, from Sky News, an economic correspondent. All this and much more on episode number 422 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast for the final week of July 2015. I'm your host, Andrew Horowitz, and we are going to be speaking with a great guest, someone who I've wanted to talk to for some time, who is a great writer. He tweets quite often on the whole area of, you know, the whole government and economics and all the things going on in Europe, and particularly focusing on Greece because there has been a lot going on there, and he does a good job at cutting through a lot of the nonsense and breaking some good news. Ed Conway from Sky News. I'm going to be talking to him shortly. But before we do that, I thought there was a few things I wanted to bring up. First of all, if you have any questions for me at any time, you could send an email to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You could also follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz, one word, is the actual Twitter handle. And feel free to hit me on that whenever you can. We have a lot of things that go out on that. You'll see notes about DH Unplugged, the Disciplined Investor Podcast, various tweets throughout the day on markets, and some silliness, of course, here and there. But that's Andrew Horowitz over on Twitter. Okay, a lot of things I want to talk to you about. First, I think I'd mentioned that this weekend, I don't know what happened. It may have happened to you in the past, but all of a sudden my iPhone went kaplooey, just stopped working. I didn't know what it was. I thought maybe it could be batteries. So I tried to charge it. Nothing. Black screen, nothing happening. I was just doing my thing and looked down and boom, black screen. So battery wasn't. The only thing that came to my mind was possibly the dreaded water damage. And then, oh my. So I have an iPhone 6 and I've had it for, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 months, I suppose. So I went online to get an appointment over at the Genius Bar over at Apple. And they said, this is now on a Sunday. And the first available was Thursday. That's not going to work. No way. What am I going to do here? So I looked around seeing there's another way to kind of finagle my way in there. And I said, just screw it. So I took a ride to the store and I went in there at about 1:30 in the afternoon. And I talked to the nice gent in the blue shirt. And I said, listen, you got to help me out here. And as it turns out, I guess, while it's really a good idea to have a Genius Bar appointment, not exactly necessary at all times. I thought on a Sunday it was going to be pretty bad. So I got them to write down my name about an hour later, which wasn't terrible. I got called up. They did a little search. They said, okay, good news. No water damage. We're going to give you a new phone. I'm like, okay, what's wrong with it? They said it doesn't work. I said, well, that's what I said. Is there anything more technical that you can tell me? Well, not really. So what we're going to do is we're going to give you a new phone for free. I said, oh, well, that just works. That's great. So while I was there, I waited around, and they came out with the phone, and they ring it up, and they do their little thing with it to give me the phone. Oh, look at that, they said. I said, what? Well, somehow you were randomly selected for an extra in-depth review of why the phone's not working. I said, you got to be kidding me. Nope. Okay. So they went to the back room, somewhere where they hide back there. I'd like to go on one of those back rooms of Apple one of these days and see what the inventory is and what they have going on back there. But anyway, they come back and they say, oh, just to let you know, I'm going to help you out here. I said, yes, there is water damage. I said, oh, really? But none of the indicators lit up. I said, well, what does that mean? Well, there was some moisture in there, but nothing on the indicators said that was water damage. So what we can do is still give you a new phone for free. okay, so I did that and kind of sat there watching all of the different people and all the problems and all the things they were having with their, you know, some watches and all that. You know, one of the things that was interesting was the Apple, a couple of the Apple people I was talking to, and we talked about the iWatch a little bit, they all said that if they didn't get such a discount on the watch, they wouldn't have bought it. I wonder how many Apple employees actually bought the watch and how many of those total counts were added to the bottom line of how many watches were sold. Something to think about, because a lot of people have talked about how there's some question as to how many watches were actually sold. Now, before we get to a few other things, I just want to let you know I was also looking for a new laptop. Now, I was torn between Apple and PC. I've used Apple for a long time, and Apple you can actually run Windows on. So I said, oh, okay, that was good. I've had the 15-inch MacBook Pro for some time, but this guy, it's heavy as can be. It's cumbersome, and I want something smaller. I looked at the HP Spectra 360. I looked at Asus. I looked at the Lenovo. They were all nice. The HP Spectra 360, the one that was loaded with all sorts of stuff, I said, that's the one I really like. I can get Windows 10 on it. Supposedly, it's going to be good. But then I started thinking, well, I use the Mac for iPhoto and a few other things for personal stuff that I like to have on there. The one thing that really surprised me was on the HP, it has 8 gigabytes of memory. Okay, fine. You're not able to expand that. You're not able to add more memory because it is hard soldered, if you will, to the motherboard. How stupid is that? The inability to actually upgrade your memory. So you're stuck with 8 gigabytes for some reason. This is what computers are going to. The Apple's the same thing, by the way. The Apple that I bought, actually, just to let you know, surprise, I bought the Apple MacBook Pro 13-inch, the one with all the bells and whistles. A little bit more expensive than the HP, probably about, not double, but maybe about 70% more expensive. But there was a lot more features to it. It had a lot better of a hard drive, a lot more of a processor. It had 16 gigabytes of RAM. And you have to, again, get that at factory because that's also, whether you want 8 or 16, you can't upgrade it after you do it. It's soldered to the motherboard. So I ended up going with the Apple because I could run actually Windows. I could do this also, I guess, on a Windows machine, but I can, you know, through Parallels or VMware Fusion or Bootcamp, I can run the Windows. So we'll see how that goes. Windows 10 comes out, I'll buy it and check it out and see if I like it. The only negative is that I guess the HP had a touch screen, where the Apple doesn't. So, oh well. Anyway, I was a little bit torn for a while, but then came to my senses and decided to stay with what I had. All right, let's talk about earnings and what's going on there, because in terms of markets, there's a lot of overhang on earnings, which is clearly a mixed bag. You know, you saw that Google did really well, so did Netflix, but Apple, even though the earnings were good, the outlook was not taken very well, and they sunk. IBM is just a serial disappointment, and they stink and just doing, you know, nothing good. Their stock moved lower. And depending on where you look in terms of healthcare, you can have good and bad. You saw what happened with Biogen last week, down about 21%. Biogen, I mean, a major player in the whole healthcare area and pharmaceuticals / biotech, sinking 20%. That's pretty significant. You know, on the other hand, you're seeing like many of the HMOs doing deals and coming out with decent earnings. So it all depends on where you are in all these areas. Now, what is really interesting, airlines, even with the lower cost of fuel, they're having problems. There was some announcement by American Airlines talking about the growth of passenger and per passenger mileage and seat costs in terms of how much their revenue they're bringing in and how much they think they're going to bring in. It really kind of put a damper on the industry in general, even though some of the local carriers did very well. Alaska Airlines had a decent number. Spirit did better, but still having problems. So the airlines, I think, are another one that's very hit or miss in terms of, you know, quote unquote, you need to be a stock picker rather than just a sector or a market. Markets, obviously, we know are very concerned about the whole concept of two things. Well, actually, four things. Well, Greece, we know about, but that's put to bed for a little while. China clearly coming out with a really awful PMI. We'll get to that in a moment, talking a little bit about some of the effect on commodities, et cetera. You have the situation with the Fed, who may or may not, depending on the dots and depending on the all the different things they put into their calculations, actually go and start raising rates. Even so, such a small increase would be at least, well, it would illustrate that the Fed has the desire to bring rates higher, even in the face of all the things that are going on around the world. And then on top of that, you have the situation with earnings being questionable. Revenues are really not growing so great, even though earnings beats are still in the 70% range. Revenues beats are only in about the 50% range. Now, we saw this kind of situation midway through last quarter as well, but the end of the quarter turned out to be pretty good in terms of that picking up and seeing the beats do better. So I think that when we look at this whole, I guess all the things that are really concerning markets and the big question of whether oil was the canary in the coal mine way back when, whether the commodity structure is falling apart just because of the dollar or there's something else going on behind the scenes, like the lack of any kind of additional expansion from China, the slowdown in economic growth in China and around the world, as well as the fact that stockpiling isn't going on as much as it was, particularly back to China. So China is a big focal point here, because if they're going to be one of the biggest markets and the biggest economies in just 10 years or so, well, they have a major effect on the global economic situation. And it is very clearly being shown that while the government is doing what they can, or at least saying that they are going to do what they can to keep markets higher, the fact remains that they have not as much control about the overall economics. So we're seeing that slowdown happen there, and that's spilling over to the rest of the world. So we've been watching the news on, obviously, what's going on in Europe and Greece, and there's a lot to talk about there, and we're going to talk about that in a second with Ed Conway. Varoufakis still shooting his mouth off, causing trouble, still tweeting in various news items saying that he believes that the big plan still is to get Greece to eventually exit the euro. That's Germany's plan, and that's the big plan about the eurozone, that it's unfairly picking on Greece and basically saying that this whole deal stinks, which it kind of does. But let's get right to our guest. How about that? And maybe talk a little bit more about this and get some clarity versus just me talking about it. Then we'll come back and we'll talk about the whole commodity complex, what's going on there, and some insight on markets and stocks from some of the screens we run. And our special guest today, Ed Conway. He's the economics editor of Sky News. He is a prolific and an excellent Twitter gent. I follow him and all of the things that he writes on the various things that are going on in Europe. You can follow him at Ed Conway Sky over on Twitter. So all the way from the UK, how are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Good, thanks. All right, so let's talk a little bit about your take on this whole Greek shenanigans that are going on. The most recent being how to prevent, I suppose, a default, the EU lent money in a bridge loan to Greece to pay back the ECB. Am I missing something here, or was that totally a side deal just to make sure that there was no default?
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I'm afraid, in this great kind of miasma that is the Greece story, there not much of it is, simple. A lot of it is like way overly complicated. But in this case, it's pretty simple. Basically, they are lending money to themselves in order to pay themselves and to keep them going. But I mean, it's only kind of like one example of the ridiculousness of the Greek and indeed the European story, because it is in many ways a ridiculous story with mistake upon mistake that have been made over the course of the past, 5-6 years alone. And that's kind of before you get onto the mistakes made in the kind of formulation of the euro, that they're continually trying to kind of get out of one by one. And but the amazing thing to me really is that they do manage just about to do it, but they come ever closer to the brink of you know, allowing the whole thing to collapse every single time.
Right. It seems that way. I mean, the most recent thing I thought was interesting, because if I was to have a bet, I would have thought that Greece would have paid back the IMF, because going into what default with the IMF starts an automatic two-week process through this whole thing, and that they would actually default on the ECB payments, because somehow I remember reading that the ECB said that, you know, well, it wouldn't be a default if they don't pay us.
Yeah, that's true. Although the IMF also has quite kind of lax rules, historically at least. They have quite lax rules on defaults. They, you know, technically speaking, you don't have to, if you don't pay them for like about a month or so, then there's still no official sanction, and then there's a long process. With the IMF, I mean, you know, historically, this is what they're very proud of. No one has officially defaulted on the IMF. And, they say this time and time again, they say this. So no one has officially defaulted on the IMF. But the truth, when you actually kind of dig into it, is no one has officially defaulted on the IMF, because the IMF doesn't allow anyone to default on it. It just doesn't admit it. It's kind of, let, you know, put its head in the sand and says, okay, well, you know, other people would call this a default. We're going to call it arrears. So you're in arrears to us. So you owe us money. And then, generally speaking, you know, and I speak to quite a lot of people at the IMF, you know, when they're being frank, they say, yeah, people don't default on us because we just lend them a bit more money to pay us back with, and then hope that eventually they pay that back. And that's kind of, you know, the process continues over and over in that way. So it's kind of similar, actually, to the European situation. And the issue for the IMF, and the reason why you ideally don't want to default in a big way on the IMF, and actually why they tend not to get defaulted on whatever they call it, is because, you know, they are really the lender of last resort. They're supposed to be, you know, you only go to the IMF because no one else will lend you money. And that's why it was a bit controversial, to say the least, that Greece decided to, you know, to not to pay the IMF as opposed to anyone else. But I mean, they were in a situation where they really didn't have much money left, and things were looking pretty terrifying in Athens. So they got that close, I think.
Right. So in order to solve the problem of the extraordinary debt, what Greece has happened is they get more debt. Now, one of the things I don't understand, tell me if how I'm tracking this incorrectly, but it is my understanding that when we go back to looking at the anti-austerity policy, the Syriza party that came in and basically said, hey, you know what, big unemployment rate in Greece and austerity is not working, and we got to do something differently here, because of course we're all very hard workers here, and we're gonna, you know, we have an incredible economy that's based on so many different areas. You know, a lot of people just think it's tourism, but we have lots more than that. But the fact is, that, you know, we came in with this that, hey, we're going to fight this. And they did such in a way, they brought in this Varoufakis guy, which was, talk about amateur central. You know, what do they say? The one thing about game theory is never, you know, if you're playing game theory, never admit that you're playing game theory, which is, you know, the first rule of game theory, but that's what he did. And then he comes in and starts all sorts of problems, gets, you know, pushing around the new government in, and they bring it to the brink. And what happens is from the brink, what happens there is that they go out and they say, well, you know, we're not going to make this decision, this horrible decision. What we're going to do is we're going to leave it to a referendum, and whatever the referendum says, we're going to do. They have the referendum that comes in, and then one day later, for some unknown reason, Varoufakis resigns, and then the whole thing turns around and says, yes, we'll take the bailout. Now, what the hell happened?
Yeah. It doesn't make much sense, does it, at every step along the way? But, okay, so here's the thing, and I like you, just couldn't quite get it, you know, and I was out there. I spent, you know, a good amount of time in Greece over the course of the last, over the last few months. Been good for air miles, if nothing else, and indeed for the hotels that hold all of the journalists. They've all been fine. But it's the difficulty is, when you look at it through the prism that you and I look at it through, which is the kind of international view, an international mindset. These guys owe money to Europe. Why are they not doing this and that? Why are they trying to kind of, you know, risk leaving the euro? Asking those kind of questions, it does look very illogical. You know, they had this referendum and then they completely ignored it. You know, they have been carrying out policies that have been extremely, extremely damaging for the Greek state, and they've basically pushed themselves into another recession. And, you know, I struggle to see the logic at all. Until I got out there, and when you look at the domestic politics, you see actually a subtly different story, which is that Syriza, when they won the election, and Alexis Tsipras, still didn't have as much control as they wanted, really. And they still had an opposition which, you know, had a sizable number of seats. They had the opposition leader was the former prime minister, Samaras, Antonis Samaras. And one theory that I kind of increasingly kind of believe is, you know, perhaps this referendum wasn't really about, you know, finding the right way out of this problem for Greece. Perhaps it was really about Alexis Tsipras, the prime minister of Greece, essentially getting rid of all the opposition domestically in Greece for him. So in the space after the referendum, he got rid of this guy Samaras, who was the head of New Democracy. Suddenly he had no you know, opposition to speak of from other political parties. He got rid of Varoufakis, who had in the course of the past 6 months, you know, he is a pretty mercurial character, is one euphemism. But he got rid of Samaras. He got rid of Varoufakis as well, who was seen as, you know, possibly a contender to him in the future. And so now, although the economy is not in a great shape, and although they have even more debt, Tsipras now has even more power than he did before to do whatever he wants. So in a way, although this looks like an unmitigated failure for Greece, for many of us, you look at it from a domestic political prism, which is quite different. And actually, it looks like it was quite a smart move by Tsipras from a personal political perspective.
From a personal standpoint, but he's pretty much wrecked the country in the doing of this.
Yeah, I mean it's back in recession. It's kind of tragic in that you know, even IMF forecasts back from March or April said that Greece was going to grow faster than any other economy in
right,
Europe,
right.
Apart from Ireland. I think Ireland, actually, ironically enough, you know, Ireland and Greece were going to be the fastest. And now it's going to be the slowest. And that is purely, and this it is a tragedy of economic policy, that is purely down to the policy that's being carried out, the brinksmanship, the fact that the new government basically threw their, you know, a lot of their weight around and a lot of the toys out of the pram. And yeah, I feel sorry for the Greeks in all of this. I feel sorry for people in the country who are desperately just trying to do business and trying to earn a living, because in the meantime, life has just got very difficult because politicians, both in Greece and to some extent, you know, in Berlin and in Brussels, have essentially, you know, played around with them, you know.
Yep.
It's a sad story to me.
Now, one of the things that is interesting, that one of the components of this bailout is that Greece is going to have to do a private fund where they're going to have to sell sovereign assets in the neighborhood of about $50 billion, something like that. And, you know, again,
but they'll never get that.
They'll never get that. There's $5 billion worth of deals pending that never closed so far, I think it is, right? So
Yeah. I stood in one of those deals, actually. There's an airport. There's the old Athens airport called Ellinikon is one of those deals that was supposed to go through, you know, back towards the end of last year. And then Syriza came in and said, we're putting everything on hold. And it's a big real estate deal. It's basically about the biggest of the real estate deals they have. But you're talking, I don't have the detailed numbers, but it's certainly kind of at the most a few billion and probably hundreds of millions. So getting up to 50 billion is ambitious in the extreme, particularly if it's like a fire sale of assets, which is kind of what's happening in Greece.
So what's the future of, not so much Greece, but what's the future of the EU? I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier that the IMF never had a default. They're just, things are in arrears and nobody really admits things and they try to protect the fact. Is this all about saving face in a way that, okay, the EU and the Euro and the Eurozone experiment that by all standards seems to have really benefited Germany? I don't think anybody doubts that, right? Is this all, you know, the whole idea of this to keep the whole experiment going as long as possible and no matter how much collateral damage? I mean, there were so many rules that were broken. Listen, I think if I remember correctly, the whole idea of quantitative easing was against the constitutionality of the Eurozone, but miraculously got through.
Yes, as indeed were no bailouts. Bailouts weren't supposed to be allowed under the constitution, you know, under the treaties. And yet they find a way around them as well. And they'll continue to find their way around you know, legally enshrined principles, which I, you know, I concede to the mind of particularly an American, you know, or any country with a firm constitution seems kind of crazy that they can just continue to flout the treaties. But, you know, Europe was built not on constitutions, but on compromise and on, you know, ad hoc compromises that keep the bicycle going. I mean, that's the image that a lot of Eurocrats in Brussels would use. They talk about Europe being essentially like a bicycle, and in order for it to stay upright, it needs to keep moving forward, and that moving forward is moving towards ever closer union. And the struggle that Europe is having right now is dealing with the fact that a lot of people don't want ever closer union. And I'm talking not just about economic, but political union. We're talking about federalism. And you see it in the UK. Right now, we're gearing up for having a referendum potentially next year on our membership of the EU. And, you know, right now, the polling suggests that British people would stay in, but it's not going to be, you know, it's going to be relatively close potentially. And every time there's been a referendum like this, the favorability of the EU has come under challenge. I mean, 10 years ago in France, there was a referendum on the latest EU treaty. There was going to be an EU constitution. There was a referendum on it, and people said no. And it was an enormous, enormous kind of difficulty. It was an enormous struggle for Europe. The idea that people are falling out of love with the idea of ever closer union. And it's just a generational thing, you know. This is a structure that was set up after the Second World War, when people, you know, mistrusted the state, and they mistrusted the kind of particularly national states, and they wanted to ensure that there was a bonding, political bonding, to make sure that nothing like 1939 to 45 would ever happen again. And that generation, you know, is dying, and it's being replaced by a generation that isn't aware of the significance of the EU's kind of birthright and is a little bit more skeptical. So there is a bigger battle going on here, and there's a bigger question mark about the future of Europe.
Well, count me in that category, by the way.
Yeah, well, I bet. I mean, you know, I think it's only right that people should talk about these things. And what is a bit interesting, and I think about difficult, particularly from a British perspective, because we've always been slightly on the periphery of Europe, mm-hmm. You know, literally and figuratively. And whenever people question the pros and cons of it, which is kind of what this process in the UK is going to be, and it needs to be even-handed, there are some people who would just rather those conversations weren't had, because I think they feel quite threatened by them. And I think that's going to be an interesting thing to watch over the course of the next year and a half, is what happens in the UK, how does this debate go, and what does that imply for Berlin? Because I tell you what, the way that Greece, you know, a lot of people look at the way that Greece, you know, the whole event was handled. And a lot of people actually on the left in the UK, Labour Party and people kind of close to them, have been saying, listen, we've historically been very pro-Europe, but the way that Greece has been treated, and that's, for the background, it's generally been the left who have been pro-Europe and the right have been kind of anti-Europe. That's a massive, massive generalisation, of course. But nowadays, actually, a lot of people on the left are becoming more anti-Europe because they think that Greece was mistreated over the course of the last few years. So things are getting interesting. And, you know, the fate of Europe is one of those stories that I think is actually only going to get bigger and weightier and even more political as well as economic over the course of the next few months and indeed years.
Yeah, when it comes to the UK, though, it seems to me that there's all downside and not much upside, particularly in respect to how the UK currently is doing in their economy. Now, you guys are talking about raising rates. I mean, everybody's got to do what everybody does, right? You know, just following the leader or following the loser. I don't care what
follow
it is.
Follow the Fed.
Yeah, it's whatever. The Fed's just one giant Fed out there, you know. But what's interesting is that the UK seems to me to be, you don't have the benefit of the common currency. Therefore, the pound could be much higher than the euro, therefore slowing down the demand for the European region. But meanwhile, you have some of the negative aspects where you have to bail out Greece. I can't see how the UK is very happy about that.
Well, the Greece thing was quite, there was this kind of moment of controversy. And I was in Brussels, actually, one of those rare things. I actually broke the story on the fact that the UK might have to be involved in the bailout. We have to be indirectly involved in this bridging loan that, you know, the one that we talked about at the start, with Greece being lent money to pay itself, you know, the EU lending money to pay the EU back kind of thing. But there is an indemnity against the UK losing any money, and that's it. To some extent, some people might see it as a fig leaf against the UK being involved, because that wouldn't be politically popular. But listen, more broadly, the UK economy is actually doing rather well at the moment in some terms. In terms of employment, the unemployment rate has plummeted. It's kind of maybe hit the bottom now, but it's fallen faster than almost any other comparable period over the course of the past few decades. It's down to like 5.5%. I think it's below the US at the moment. It's certainly below most of the Eurozone countries. There's some question marks over how much of that is self-employment, how much of it's part-time employment. But, you know, that's seen as pretty good news. And actually, weirdly, frustratedly, you know, I'm an economics correspondent. You know how it is when the news is bad, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to economics. But when the news is less bad and, you know, it's pretty positive.
Yeah, boring, actually, when it boring. Comes to,
yeah, exactly. And the UK, unfortunately, much to my frustration, although I suppose good for the UK and good for the economy, is one of those boring stories right now, because most of the news has been relatively good. But, you know, it's not, you know, there are some black clouds, certainly. There's some concerns over housing, particularly in London, house prices being overvalued. There are some, you know, real concerns over productivity. You know, Larry Summers and all these people have talked about secular stagnation. We have, you know, potentially a good example of an economy where productivity just hasn't really risen. In fact, has fallen in the wake of the crisis. So, you know, in the long run, I think there's some big issues for the UK. But in the short run, weirdly, strangely, perhaps unexpectedly for a lot of people, this place is doing relatively well.
Yeah, no, UK is definitely doing well. I mean, your housing prices do look a little bit absurd, especially when you're starting to build thin and high.
Yeah.
You know, that whole thing. Yeah. It's starting to, especially in London proper, that is. I mean, obviously,
yeah,
the outskirts.
London is crazy.
Yep. Finally, I guess it was a couple of days ago, there was another vote. You know, it's got to be multiple votes in multiple time, just constantly dragging feet of the Greeks to vote the final vote in Parliament for, you know, the final vote for the final vote kind of thing. They got to vote to make a vote. And when's the vote going to be? And then we'll vote. But which seems to be a constant. Is there a potential for a, you know, them going the other way? Or is they going to just play along at this point?
I think I would say, for me, the Greece story, you know, from a journalistic perspective, and indeed I think from a markets perspective, probably goes a bit quieter for the next few months at least, because they have some of their bridge funding. They need to get back into talks, but they do have some money to pay back next month to the ECB. So, you know, there are still some question marks over a few payments, but it feels like, and it felt like, having been there in Brussels when they went through these talks, that they went through the pain barrier of a lot of these talks and are now on a similar page to, you know, to the rest of the Europeans. Alexis Tsipras, Greece, made some big compromises, and it's in everyone's interest in Europe to keep things kind of quiet over the summer. I mean, like, just from a pragmatic perspective, most of these guys quite like their holidays and have what they call the grand vacances in the summer. They go off for basically all of August. All of August is a holiday in Europe. So historically, they've been very capable of quietening things down, even during the height of the euro crisis, during that August period. But I think that come September, come the fall, I think things might get a bit more spicy again. And I think that there are some big questions over whether in Greece there might well be new elections. There could be another set of elections later on this year if Tsipras wants to, you know, get a new mandate for sorting out the economy. And there could well be, you know, some surprises when that happens. So I think that, you know, that there is the potential for political bumps along the road. And you and I both know that, and in fact, you know, most economists would agree, the debt that they have now and they've committed to is unpayable. There is no way that they will be able to pay all of this off. It will have to be either written off or defaulted on in some way. And, you know, whether that's just in a kind of, you know, doubling the maturities, or whether that's actually defaulting, or whether that's proper write-offs, you know, who knows? That's a question for Wolfgang Schäuble and for the other finance ministers in Europe. But this, in the long run, that needs to be dealt with. But this is Europe. They push things off, and they'll push it off decades into the future, and then at some point they might have to deal with it. Or at some point by then, what will the EU be? Maybe it'll exist in the same form. Maybe there'll be a federal union. Maybe they'll have mutualized loads of their debt already. And maybe the whole thing won't exist at all. So, you know, as far as they're concerned, this is a kind of, they are working on a centuries-long project. And this is one small bump in the road. And they'll just keep things going, keep that bike rolling along as far as they can. But there will be some serious bumps, like I said, both with Greece and indeed with the UK referendum coming up.
Well, you know what this does, though? There's a silver lining here for Ed Conway. You know what? You know,
that?
Job security.
Yeah. Well, you say that.
We hope.
Who knows?
Knock
the FD is being sold. The world is changing, you know?
Yep.
The media landscape changes all the time. And who knows? Who knows, you know, how people are going to, whether people are going to pay for information in the future. But that's another question entirely.
Yep. I appreciate Ed Conway, economics editor of Sky News. You can follow him over at Ed Conway Sky. And, of course, take a look at Sky News online and all the different things that he's writing and following on Greece, UK, and Europe. Thanks so much, buddy. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, cheers. Good stuff. Good stuff from Ed Conway. I really appreciate him coming on. And hopefully you got a lot out of that I did as well. So, before we got to Ed, I mentioned some things that we were going to talk about, and I wanted to touch on those right now. You know, we talked about briefly in the beginning of the show about the whole canary in the coal mine concept and what's going on with commodities, but take a look at some of the things that have been going on, right? We see that oil has been breaking down very significantly. We did see the recent pop in the first quarter of this year and then the continuation of the down cycle, particularly with some of the things that are going on with Iran and the concern that they'll be pumping more, Saudi Arabia not slowing down on any of their production as well, and the production in the United States and refining in particular really hitting highs. If you look at the refining capacity, what's been going on and the amount of oil that's being produced and refined, I should say, not taken up from the ground necessarily, but refined, there's a lot of refining going on, and still consumption is not as significant. We did see that there was a build in inventories significantly last week and turning around from what we did see was a draw. But we did not only look at the whole idea of, well, it's just oil anymore, right? You got to look at copper. Copper's been plunging along with platinum, palladium, silver, and even gold. Now, gold less than silver and platinum and palladium. Nickel, copper, those are more the industrial materials. The question is, why are they all falling? You know, I can give you some thought that, okay, well, you know, there's a big concern that the Fed's going to raise interest rates. And as such, we are seeing that even if it may be a slight move, there's a big tick up in the dollar. The U.S. economy is doing better. We saw 255,000 print last week on initial claims. That's pretty good. Manufacturing's okay, and home sales are all right. GDP is just coming in okay, but still better than a lot of areas in terms of the structure of what's happening around the world. And in the fact that, insofar as the fact we have the Fed on a tightening course, quote unquote tightening, not really trying to slow down the economy, but trying to put just a insignificant amount of idea in the heads of, I think, the markets that they can and will have the power to slow things down and want to see as a test what happens. But the rest of the world is loosening. The rest of the world is in a declining situation. And we're sitting here outside in a situation where our economy is a little bit better. The problem, though, is, of course, that as our economy slows, their economy slows even more. So even though we're seeing some okay economic conditions in the United States, still not great. But again, comparatively, it is possibly quite a bit better than we're seeing around the world. Now, that is helping the dollar move higher, which could be the reason why gold and silver have not been doing well. But what about copper? What about platinum? What about nickel? The fact is that this is all predicated on the fact that you have China slowing down and a dollar that is rising. So it's a combination plan. It's a 1-2 punch. And when you look at these, you have to wonder, how much further they have to go? Where are we going to see the end of this cycle? Last week we saw that there was a news item that I think the headline was something like gold futures traders are the shortest they've ever been on the history of records. Commitment of Traders report came out, and there was some other commodities traders report that came out that said that the net shorts on gold was the highest it's ever been. I think it's actually the first time they're actually net short. Usually you have a net long position in gold. But now when you take this calculation, you look at the futures traders and they put it all together, there's a net short exposure for the first time in history. The truth be known, it's not the first time in history. Records go back about a dozen years maybe at the most. So it's just as that is the first time that there is a net short on the record books from when these records were kept. But looking back to different times and different cycles, there were the other times that you could calculate that there was a net short position in the gold market. But okay, all right, so what? The fact is that gold is seeing a major decline. It doesn't seem to get any legs. Although Friday it did come up pretty nicely. Nice turnaround. One of the reasons? Probably because all the news out there about the short positions that are being held. And we've talked about this so many times on the show that anytime there is euphoria and there is pretty much everybody on one side of the boat, the opportunity for a quick rush to the other side and then a squeeze, if you will, a short squeeze, is very, very high. And that, I think, is what's happening with gold to a degree. Now, I don't know if it's going to stay in a mode where we can see a little bit of a move higher here, whether it's a day or a week. I'm not talking about, you know, quick. I'm talking about weeks at a time. But the fact of the matter is that there is some value there. But more so, I'm really looking at the copper as something that I kind of scratch my head and you wonder, wow, is it really that bad with copper? And you look at all the short positions on this, and I just will tell you that, again, if my thesis is right, that we'll probably see the shorts building into positions, and then there'll be a massive short squeeze. You'll see a 40, a 50, you know, point day, or maybe even higher, on gold to the upside one of these days, because you'll see some piece of data that comes out that is contradictory to the strength of the dollar, maybe the Fed not raising rates as quickly, whatever it may be. And all of a sudden, everybody's going to the other side of the boat in a big way, covering their positions and buyers coming out to squeeze them. So keep a watch on gold. Keep a watch on the gold miners who have been hurt even more. If you take a look at GDX, if you take a look at some of these gold miners, man, their stocks are just hammered. Look at Freeport McMoRan. Stock was down 20% the last 2 days. 20% after it's been down 40 and 50%. Now, actually, with that move down about 20% for Freeport McMoRan, on Friday we entered a very small option position for a trade, not for a hold, but for a trade. We picked up the August calls with a strike of 13 with the blood in the streets theory being played here. There is this blood in the streets when it comes to many of these commodity players. A lot of the, we talked about the oils, we talked about the gold miners, we talked about this whole commodity complex is falling apart. It really is. And at this time, you know, you wonder, is there anybody that really believes that they could ever come back, or are they going to go, you know, maybe bankrupt? So there's clearly blood in the streets when it comes to these commodity players, and which is clearly at the opposite end of the spectrum from the rest of the market, clearly from technology, healthcare, and staples, and maybe even to a point consumer discretionary. I mean, we're talking about an opposite extreme here where these guys are just looking just putrid. You know, the companies are not able to make the money they made because there's an excess of supply. And the fact of the matter is, for many of these materials, the cost factors of bringing them up and refining it or cleaning it or at least mining it in a way is higher than what they can sell it for. That's a big problem. And obviously, it's a very easy calculation and easy thing to look at to see whether or not there is going to be, you know, earnings that are significantly negative or just negative. Either way, they're going to be negative. So keep a look at some of these areas at, put them on your radar screen for just something to be looking at that may be beneficial in the next couple of months. For a trade, I'm talking about. Just talking about for a trade. not an actual long-term investment here. I mean, it may turn into that eventually, but again, using options, which are very levered, which I'm not recommending you do this, but I'm just telling you what we are doing, can be very beneficial. We were actually short through a put the small caps last week. I think small caps are down about 4.5% or 5% from their highs this year. The Dow is now down for the year. The S&P is virtually flat. NASDAQ is doing well. But we were actually in a put, a long position in a put, on effectively short the small caps, which held the portfolios very nicely last week. We had a nice position there. Plus, still short the Yang, or I should say short Hang Seng Index through Yang, which is a three-time ETF, which is we've been in and out of. You know, we were pretty well hedged until Friday, and now we see that there is the potential for a little bit of a less of a need to be as hedged in the portfolios. We'll take a look at that as the sentiment and the actual oversold, overbought indicators give us a better signal. Something I want to talk to you about, which I thought was really interesting, is a lot of different ways in which people look to, we'll call it balance and allocate their portfolios. So maybe I'll give you a very simple concept. 60-40. 60% stocks, 40% bonds, or vice versa. The old, oh, let me take 100 minus my age. So I take 100, I subtract, let's just call it 50. 50% stocks, 50% bonds. As I get older, we see that, of course, if I'm 70, 70 from 100 means 30. 30 stocks, 70 bonds. The theory is that the older you get, the more you should be looking to have a much more diversified approach towards fixed income, because the risk factors in a portfolio are such that you don't want to have the volatility and the risk of equities. Again, just ideas, just something that you hear out there. But one of the things we do for our portfolios that we really like in terms of the TDIMG growth strategy is that we look at the fundamentals from a much different perspective than you would think. So economics, as you have probably seen, can be good or bad, and that has maybe a bearing or not on markets. Long-term negative fundamentals will obviously hurt markets long-term. Long-term good fundamentals will benefit markets long-term. But in between, especially when we have so many central banks liquefying markets and wanting to create a wealth effect through markets, and some of them more overt than others, the truth is that it's very difficult to understand exactly where you should be, because at any given time, central bankers can change things up. But one of the things that you can do is you can study stocks, right? You can study what is the earnings growth of a particular stock. What is EBITDA? What is the enterprise value? What is the ROE, ROA? What is the margins? How are they progressing historically compared to what they are now, compared to the markets, things like that, compared to other stocks, compared to sectors? Well, one of the things that we do for our portfolio is we start with about 5,000 stocks, okay, 5,000 stock universe. And then we start chipping away by putting on filters, putting on a screening filter that says, okay, we want to have, certain margins currently and historically. We want to see that you have an expanding margin by this amount per year. We want to see that, for example, that you have, I'll give you an example, a 20 or more percent growth in your earnings on the last 5 years and the last quarter over last year's quarter. We want to see at least a growth of at least 20 and possibly even 25%. And you can kind of go back and do different time periods, et cetera. We want to see revenue growth as well. So you put all these different parameters in a screen. And what happens is it's the first part of what I think is a really good investment strategy to come up with stocks that are superior in terms of management and the company's ability to continue growing in various situations, whether it's good or bad economies. Now, when you do that and when you do something like that, you get a number of stocks that come through your screen. So we took that one step further. So let's say, for example, I'll give you just some numbers here. There's 100 stocks that come through a screen. And you may have heard us talk about this a little bit before, but 100 stocks that come through that particular screen, okay? And we use this for our core portfolio. And we say, okay, well, we got all these stocks that come through the screen. Well, we could say that on average, how many stocks have come through that screen in various economic conditions? Well, if your average is, let's say, 75, and all of a sudden you have 100, you could probably make the or come to the conclusion that companies are able, more so now than were before on average, to come up with better earnings growth, come up with better revenue growth, to look at ROE and management's ability to do this and that. And you know what? Maybe that, generally speaking, should be a good time. So we're not looking at the economics. We're looking at the fundamentals and then looking at how big of the universe it is of stocks compared to how big the universe was on average and in history to see how stocks are doing. Now, what we had for a long time was about 70, then we went to 65, and then we have 63, currently at about 62. Okay, so that's starting to show that there's something happening, but nothing major, right? From 70 to 60 is not that big of a swing. Percentage-wise, it's a big swing. But again, things are still okay. There's a margin of error in stocks that will make it and won't make it. Well, here's some news for you. The most recent run of this particular screen, which was this week, we saw only 44 stocks make it through the screen. So again, what does that mean? That means that only 44 stocks compared to where 60 or 70 before were able to have increasing earnings in a significant way that signifies that they're able to keep pace with our strict criteria, but more so that they're able to really keep pace with a very substantial earnings growth. And what that means is, and what should tell you, since earnings are the biggest part of what should be the underlying valuation currently and into the future for markets, is that something isn't right. Because if you can't keep up your earnings and your revenue or your various different statistics that we put on this, what we're finding is that companies are finding it harder and harder to make money. Even though there's a lot of share buybacks, even though that we saw that companies are expanding and globally, something is not going right because we're finding that less and less companies are able to make the cut. Does that make sense? From there, what we could say is we want to have a lower exposure, at least temporarily, for equities until such time that more companies can come on and show that there is a much greater ability for companies in general to have significant growth above average for revenues and for earnings. So take that and think about that for a moment and the importance from a historical perspective of what that means. What we have found is that in times where we do eventually see economic contraction or at least a slowdown, we see less stocks start to come into our screens beforehand. So this is an advance. So we got to keep a watch on what's going to happen with the economy in the U.S. Let's forget about central banks for a second, just for a moment. Just throw them out the window. Just forget about it entirely. Let's not even deal with that whole concept of the invisible hand or the safety net or whatever you want to call it, because we're just talking about the fundamentals right now. And I don't care what the Fed does. And really, unless they just pass out more money than they ever did before, right now we're pretty much at rock bottom rates. Fact of the matter is, if companies are having a harder time earning money net to the bottom line, maybe hard time gathering revenues. It could be because the dollar's strong. That's a big issue, right? We know the dollar's strong and they're not selling as much goods. Something to be aware of, something to think about, something to consider in the big picture of things. Now, if we do see that we get even a more significant cut down in the actual number, let's call it down to, let's say it gets down to 30. I think it's only been down to 30 a couple of times in the last 10 or 15 years from what we looked at. If it gets down there, that's going to be a big problem. While some companies, even in very difficult economic circumstances and even in difficult times, can still make money, the fact is that that is showing that it's much more difficult on average. And what we do is really hedge out pretty strongly and move a lot more to cash. That's the kind of concept. That's what we need to think about. So you don't have to worry about the emotional side of things, right? You don't have to worry about, oh, should I, shouldn't I? I don't really know. Well, this is telling us something isn't right on Wall Street. So think about that. I'm going to be on Frank Curzio's podcast coming up. I think he's in Vancouver next week, but we're still going to do a show, and he's going to have me as his guest. So if you go over to iTunes and grab the Frank Curzio podcast with, I think it's called Wall Street Unplugged, you can go get that and check that out. I'll be his guest, and we'll have some good things to talk about, I'm sure, because when I spend time with Frank, we always have a good time and talk about some cool stuff. Again, I mentioned that if you want to ask any questions, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com or visit thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Listen to me on Tuesday nights with John C. Dvorak on DH Unplugged. And of course, follow me on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz. Thanks for joining me. We'll be back next week with another great guest. We have a lot of guests lined up, actually, over the next several weeks. Some new ones, some ones you've heard before, but definitely a couple of new ones that are going to be pretty interesting. Jim Rogers is going to be on. I think we're going to have Das on. He's going to be a little while out into the future. We have some cool traders coming on as well. Anyway, thanks for joining me, and I will see you and talk to you shortly. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.